This is International Portfolio, and I'm Frank Blair in New York. Coming up, we'll hear about one of the most pressing problems now facing the United States, the growing turmoil in Central America. Tensions grow as rebels battle the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Leftist guerrillas challenge the military junta in El Salvador, and government forces crack down on rebel Indians in Guatemala. And we'll take a long look at America's defense policy. Are we building up our forces in a sensible way? Does the West's defense posture depend on a strong West Germany? And what is the outlook for future German-American relations? To begin, let's go to Mexico City to hear veteran journalist Lou Garcia.
With me today to discuss the outlook in El Salvador is Alan Writing, the Mexico City bureau chief of the New York Times and author of the forthcoming book, Mexico, People and Power. Mr. Writing has reported from Central America since the early 70s, and in that sense, he has a unique perspective over the process of change in the region. Mr. Writing, it seems that almost overnight, El Salvador has become an important part of daily politics in the United States. But I wonder, did these problems of El Salvador explode suddenly, or were they brewing for a long time and we simply weren't watching?
Well, I think you can certainly go back to around 1972 to trace the beginnings of the disintegration of the political system in El Salvador. A lot of people recall that since 1932, the country had had military rulers without interruption. And it was also one of the countries with perhaps the greatest extremes of wealth and poverty. And perhaps one of the cliches in recent times is that what is happening in Salvador today is a result of these extremes of wealth and poverty. My own view is that it's really been a problem of political management. Almost, in a sense, the inability of the political system to deal not with poverty, but to deal with growth. One had in the 60s a period of remarkable growth in El Salvador and in much of Central America. And this brought a new urban, a new middle class, and that new middle class began to want a different political system. One began to see this in the late 60s, and in 1972 it finally resulted in the election of a Christian Democrat president. Again, hardly a radical solution, but it seemed to be, for the military and for the right-wing business and landed class of El Salvador, a too radical a solution. And so there was a fraud, and at that time, of course, the winner, who was not allowed to take office, was a man called Duarte, who was shipped to Venezuela in exile. So really, that first opportunity of changing the political structure of the country was missed. And one of the results was the emergence of the first guerrilla movements. In El Salvador, the armed movement only began in the 70s, and while not exclusively the result of the 1972 electoral fraud, in many ways one can say this is the point when a lot of people realized that peaceful change was not going to be possible, and they began to seek some sort of guerrilla option. That took us through to the next opportunity to save the situation, which were elections in 1977. We had very much of a repeat of what happened in 72. Again, a probable opposition victory and a certain fraud, and frustration began to grow even more in the country. And these, again, I emphasize, political problems. The poverty was always there, and it was a question really of how these problems were being managed. Finally, after the Nicaraguan Revolution of July 1979, the United States, to some extent, but even the Salvadoran army began to realize that they were getting themselves into what was described as a pre-insurrectional situation. And so one had, in October 79, a coup d'etat against the general who was imposed in 77, General Romero, and one began to get a different rhetoric. The young officers took over and said, no, we must save ourselves from the Marxist-Leninist revolution. We must have a reformist revolution, in a sense. Carried out, they promised all sorts of reforms, and after a few weeks it was apparent that they were not going to take place. All this was an incredible process of social disintegration. There were guerrilla activities, there was murder, there was a lot of massacres of peasants who were being mobilized by the left, and really the society was falling apart, but no one was noticing.
Getting to now the guerrilla movement, who are these guerrillas? It started off with the university students. Are they still the ones who are leading the change or want the change?
Quite a lot of the guerrillas did come from the universities. There are five different groups, and each one has a different emphasis in terms of its support base and so on. The interesting thing, and perhaps the most dramatic thing about the guerrillas in El Salvador, is that they, much more than the Sandinists in Nicaragua, much more than any guerrilla group in Latin America so far, managed to establish a genuine alliance with some of the peasantry. This was done to some extent through the role of the radical church, a lot of priests working in the countryside, and they felt that there was a great need for organization by the peasants. The only way they were going to be able to respond to repression and oppression was to organize themselves. And at some point, they essentially began to mobilize the politics of the peasants and turn them into the raw material for a peasant guerrilla movement. One is seeing a genuine revolution in parts of the country in El Salvador. It's not just radicalized middle-class students. However, in some of the groups, there's no question about it that the leadership does remain of that stratus.
The left has decided not to take part in the elections, and they prefer to discuss power sharing in negotiations. What now?
I think everyone who has been to Salvador, who has followed this, knows very well that the elections are not going to solve the situation. The last elections demonstrated that as soon as the elections were over, the different parties on the right, the little groups, the little elites, the little cliques that run these countries and run El Salvador, just began sharing out power among themselves. And so people who had, on that single day, voted with great enthusiasm, their enthusiasm evaporated very quickly. The problem with negotiations in El Salvador, and in fact elsewhere in Central America, is that the parties to negotiations still want to use negotiations to win. That is, they're looking for negotiated victories, not for negotiated pieces. And my feeling is that in El Salvador, the reason that we're not moving towards any sort of conciliatory approaches is that no one is genuinely willing to make concessions. The left still believes that in the long run it will win, and the United States still thinks it can defeat and wipe out the left. It doesn't really accept the idea of the left participating in government, participating in any way with a permanent presence of power, because the feeling is that as soon as you let them in a little bit, they're going to take over, so you can't let them in at all. And so I think that it becomes all rather surreal.
Let's broaden the discussion just a bit more and go into the entire of Central America. It appears from this distance that there is a spreading of the violence in Salvador. It's now going across the borders into Honduras and between Honduras and Nicaragua. Where are we going from here? Is it spreading?
Well, there is no question that there is, in a sense, unrest, instability, violence spreading in Central America. It's not quite clear that it's spreading from El Salvador. Those of us in the region have always felt that, in fact, the central point of Central America, geographically, politically, is in fact Nicaragua and not El Salvador. Nicaragua offered in 1979 the hope of a sort of different type of revolution, which was a revolution halfway between, if you like, the Cuban Revolution and some of the more liberal democracies once. There was obviously a need for some sort of revolutionary process, but people were hoping it would not fall into the hands of Cuba, that it would not be a repeat of that model. And I might say that a lot of leftists in Latin America were hoping for that. In reality, one has begun to see some wavering of that political model, of that political hope, and I think that the radicalization that has taken place in Nicaragua, with or without the prompting of the Reagan administration, that radicalization has done quite a lot of harm to the opportunities for reformist or revolutionary experiments elsewhere in the region. It is now very difficult, for example, for the Salvadorian left to say, we are going to have political pluralism and so on, and we're going to have real non-alignment.
Was Nicaragua the first domino, so to speak?
Now, the domino theory obviously is part of the Vietnam syndrome that has been awakened by the whole problem in Central America. I personally feel that if there's any domino, the one pushing down the domino is the United States, because it is actually going around spreading instability, trying to move Central America back to restore the sort of system of stability that worked 50 years ago but can't work today. One has to find new formulas of stability. And if we go back to seeking those old systems of stability, then we're not going to find it. We're just going to go on and on and on.
Is the main problem here then in Central America and Salvador basically an economic problem?
To some extent, but I insist that it's the problem of political management. When the political managers of a country start resorting to massive repression because they haven't got any other way of dealing with it. One sees a lot of poverty in Latin America and in the Third World. One even sees authoritarianism and poverty combined, and that does not necessarily mean revolution. I mean, we're talking in Mexico City, and here is a country with an authoritarian political system and with probably the greatest extremes of wealth and poverty, or almost the greatest in all of Latin America, and yet we don't have a revolutionary situation despite an acute economic crisis because of political management. And I think in Central America, people have to find new formulas of political management.
Do you think the United States has to change its foreign policy for Central America, if it is going to be involved as it is?
Well, I fear it's rather late in a way to change its policy towards Central America. In a way, Central America is the opportunity for it to change its policy towards other parts of the world. In other words, one can't wait until the situation is boiling and expect to be able to deal with it. But there were opportunities in the case of El Salvador in 1972, in 1977, in 1979, all occasions where, had the United States been really watching it, it could have applied pressure. In the case of 72 fraud, in the case of 77 fraud, it basically accepted these frauds. In the case of the 1979 reformist coup, it did not apply any pressure to carry out the promises of that coup until it was too late. Now, I often ask myself, are we learning the lessons of Central America in taking different attitudes, say, towards Bolivia or Peru or Chile or Argentina? Are we thinking about those countries? We talk a great deal about democracy in Central America, but are we trying to look for democratic solutions where the situation hasn't got too bad?
What about the rest of Central America? What's at stake here for the United States?
The United States does not have important economic stakes in the region. I think it's important to establish that. That removes it, if you like, from the traditional Marxist analysis. Its only importance is strategic. The extent to which Central America at any point appears to be participating in the East-West conflict, threatening to the United States, then it becomes important. Now, my personal view is that while there's no question about the importance of Central America to the United States in political and strategic terms, one has to ask oneself, what is the best way the United States can protect itself? Does it protect itself with having a series of right-wing regimes and a great deal of militarization and a great deal of repression against the left? Or does it protect itself by looking for viable economic and political formulae? These countries are not countries that want to be communist, if you like. The people have been brainwashed against communism for years. And in any event, they're people who actually, at most levels, admire the United States, above all admire American values, and would like to have those values themselves. The sort of communism of social security, for example, that's what people dream of. Those are the sort of things people are looking for in the area. And those are the things that would give the area its own stability, and that is a way that the United States can best protect itself, to help find economic and political formulas that do not involve a constant repression, be it of the left or indeed of the right. The idea of simple solutions won't work. One has to be patient. It's taken 10 or 15 or 20 years for Central America to get into this mess, quite apart from the hundreds of years before that. And it's going to take 5, 10, 15 years to be able to find solutions that will actually have some sort of viability. When one asks oneself, what is Central America going to be like in the year 2000? Are they going to be economically better off? Are they going to have democracies? It's very difficult to imagine that they're going to be better off and that they're going to have democracies. And the only way they might do is if one demonstrates extraordinary patience. Unfortunately, patience in foreign policy is not one of the virtues of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Writing. From Mexico City, this is Lou Garcia for International Portfolio.
Thank you, Lou Garcia. Now back to New York to find out what our response should be. Here's Paul Kreisberg of the Council on Foreign Relations.
With me today here is James Chase, Managing Editor of Foreign Affairs Quarterly, the author of a recent highly regarded book entitled Solvency, and of an equally well-received long essay in the New York Review of Books last fall on Central America. Mr. Chase, in the present turmoil and revolutionary strife in Central America, do you think this can be ascribed primarily to long-term underlying social and economic pressures in the area? Or have these pressures fundamentally been affected by Cuban and then Nicaraguan willingness to encourage and promote revolution?
I think that the present turmoil in Latin America, the coups and revolutions which have brought a leftist government to Nicaragua in 1979 and have seen increasingly strong guerrilla action in El Salvador clearly have their roots in the long-standing economic and social problems of the area. Let's not forget, moreover, that the United States has also been deeply involved in the history of that tragic part of the world. We have sent the Marines into those areas in earlier parts of the century. We've had strong economic interests down there. The entrenched interests of the area have definitely contributed to a great deal of social inequity. That said, clearly there has been, and will continue to be in my view, Cuban encouragement of revolution in the area, and with a regime in Nicaragua which is moving towards a Marxist-Leninist state, there is also likely to be a good deal of encouragement by the Nicaraguan government on these same lines. In short, the presence of the Cuban Revolution, the success of the Nicaraguan Revolution, is bound to aid and abet the revolutionaries in the area. It would be very odd indeed if that did not happen.
How serious would revolutionary successes be in this area for the United States? If the revolution was successful in El Salvador, is this going to sweep next through Honduras and Guatemala and then ultimately up into Mexico?
Well, let's take a look, first of all, at the three countries. Let's try to look at the situation as it pertains now in the year 1983. The Nicaragua Revolution in 1979 overcame years of a dictatorial family, the Somoza family, and it was a revolution that had broad support from many sectors of the country. It was not a small, dedicated band of revolutionaries. It had support from the enlightened business community and also from the church as a whole, from the hierarchy of the church, as well as the fact that the Nicaraguan people are very devout Catholics. So you had a revolution which was very broadly based. It was also a revolution which was committed to three basic principles. One was to have a mixed economy, partly private, partly public owned. Second, there was a commitment to political pluralism. And third was a commitment to a foreign policy of non-alignment, that is to say, not aligning itself with either the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, or the United States. However, since 1979, much has changed in Nicaragua. The Nicaragua regime has become closely aligned to the Soviet Union. The economy, while it still maintains a fairly sizable private sector, nevertheless has moved very swiftly to nationalize the major sector of the economy, and there's no question that private business is suffering. Most seriously at the moment, however, is its commitment to pluralism. There is certainly opposition allowed in Nicaragua. There is, for example, an opposition newspaper, La Prensa. But the notion that other political parties will be contending for power seems very hard to come upon. By and large, the revolutionaries, the Sandinistas, have consolidated power within the governing directorate. And as a consequence, the Nicaraguan Revolution today seems to be moving in a increasingly authoritarian direction, an authoritarianism of the left.
But there are some people who say that opposition is growing so strong that there is a genuine possibility of the Nicaraguan government being overthrown.
There's no question that there is opposition to the direction the regime is moving in. It's very hard to say whether that will translate itself to actually overthrowing the current regime. In this respect, however, it seems to me that if the United States supports openly those forces who are opposed to the regime, it is likely to have the paradoxical effect of strengthening the regime. Once again, a small country will see itself threatened by a large country such as the United States, and it will give the members of the ruling directorate a better ability to mobilize the people against any outside invaders as they would see them. Moving on to El Salvador, there too you have had a coup in 1979 by a group of army officers. The junta that took over and tried to make some reforms, but ultimately the junta itself split into factions, and the most liberal members of the army faction are now in exile from El Salvador. What this has meant is that you've seen in the last 3 years a military which has been largely aligned to the long-term right-wing forces of El Salvador. There has been little effort made to have any fundamental social and economic reforms in El Salvador, though some amount of land reform has been put into effect, largely at the urging of the United States. The situation that obtains in 1983, however, is an army which has not been effective in winning the hearts and minds of the Salvadoran people, besieged by an increasingly powerful guerrilla forces. It is also true that the guerrillas have not gained widespread popular support either. If there's one cry that the Salvadoran people have, it is for peace. But it is the peace which has so far eluded them. The guerrillas are gaining in strength as the army fights not as strongly as it might. By that I mean the army tends to fight during the week and take off on the weekends, which is no way to win a guerrilla battle. In the meantime, the guerrillas themselves have changed their tactics so as to increase their popularity among the people by releasing prisoners and by generally trying to treat the towns they occupy with a good deal of careful circumspection. In Guatemala, there has been a long-standing history of left-wing guerrilla movements. But in the early 1980s, the guerrilla leaders had begun to organize among the most oppressed classes of Guatemala, that is to say the Indians particularly along the Mexican border. At that point, there was also a coup by General Rios Montt, who then remobilized the army to take on an offensive to eradicate the guerrilla strongholds in Guatemala. It has been a very bloody offensive, and has been, at least in the short run, successful. By that I mean the guerrillas have been on the defensive. Many of the Indians and the guerrillas themselves have fled into neighboring Mexico. But there undoubtedly will be costs to this program. The measures that have been taken to eradicate the guerrilla movement have been very severe indeed. And the likelihood is that in the long run, the guerrilla movement may yet find new life, aided and supported either because it is on the border with Mexico or simply because the resentment in the Indian villages will be so great that if the guerrilla movement is crushed today, it may yet arise tomorrow.
How serious are all of these activities for the United States? Is the United States' real security interests involved? After all, our concern is for the Panama Canal. Nicaragua is already a sharply leftist state. How much more serious would it be for the United States if El Salvador were to become a more radically leftist state?
The revolutions per se in Central America do not affect U.S. interests directly. The greatest interests in the area are clearly the fate of the major regional powers, powers like Venezuela, Colombia, and especially Mexico. Mexico because it is one of our largest trading partners, Mexico because of its resources, its oil, and Mexico because of the great problems we now have with it involving migration and illegal immigration into the United States. Clearly our interests with Mexico are very deep and very closely interwoven. How, therefore, would Mexico be likely to be affected by the turmoil in Central America? Mexico is very concerned by it. There's no question about that. But Mexico's way of trying to look for stability in that area is very different from that of the Reagan administration. What Mexico has sought are negotiations and has been very critical of the U.S. military involvement in the area. So will revolutionary uprising ultimately spread to Mexico? A question mark which no one can answer. But surely the Mexicans themselves must have as great a sense of their own vulnerability as we do for them. And to this degree, it is important to recognize that the Mexicans would like to follow a policy of negotiation in order to gain stability.
Well, let's look at what the potential for resolving this conflict in the area is. I'd like to have your comment on whether, if the use of troops is not appropriate, how would you see a diplomatic or negotiating a solution which could lead to peace and stability in the area?
It is very difficult indeed to see any reason for use of U.S. troops in the area. Indeed, it is likely that any use of U.S. troops would prove counterproductive, even for those countries which might be sympathetic to American aims in the area. The use of American troops would certainly bring forth the historical legacy of U.S. intervention, and we would lose many friends and influence in not only in that area, but throughout all of Latin America. Any use of U.S. troops, therefore, would have to have a very clear and present danger where the support of those troops would be widespread, not only within the United States, but abroad. The only situation that I can foresee where the use of troops might be valid and productive would be the presence of Soviet bases in the area, or even a Cuban expeditionary force on the mainland. If this were to occur, then direct U.S. military involvement might become necessary and might indeed get the support, which I've suggested is necessary to have a successful conclusion in the area. What do we really mean indeed by a successful conclusion? What we're really talking about is an element of stability, not the overturning of regimes, whether they be the left or of the right. Moreover, the solutions to the area if they are not military, are not necessarily economic, as has also been suggested by some of the critics of this administration, unless there is some way of ensuring some redistribution of monies, some way of ensuring that the money is actually going to do some good, economic solutions alone are not enough. So we're caught in a very severe dilemma. A military solution is likely to be counterproductive for the United States. On the other hand, economic aid alone will not do the trick. What we're really coming to, it seems to me, is to try to look for a general solution of stability wherein each country will have to work out its own destinies the best it can. How can we get, therefore, to a situation of some stability? There are three negotiations which could take place that I think might lead to some form of stability in the area. The first would be a negotiation between the United States and Cuba, some way in which perhaps we would be able to point out to the Cubans that it's their interest to stay out of direct involvement in Central America, in return for which we might be able to have better relations diplomatically with Havana, and perhaps even be able to use some economic carrots as well as the military threats or sticks. A second negotiation would involve the United States with Nicaragua. Here, too, we're talking about the need for Nicaragua to distance itself from the direct alignment it has with Havana and to agree with the Soviet Union. How to do this? The United States might well agree to withdraw its active support of the counter-revolutionary elements operating against Nicaragua from Honduras. It might offer, again, an economic carrot just as it withdrew the military stick. A third negotiation, and perhaps the most serious of all, would, of course, be with El Salvador, where the situation is very much in flux. Here, I think there is a real need to bite a bullet which has risks, which is to look for a power sharing between the Salvadoran military and the military of the guerrilla forces. But in this respect, how is one to get a successful negotiation that would lead to power sharing between two such opposed forces? To this end, I think one would have to look for some restructuring of the El Salvadoran military. There are officers of a more liberal bent, some of whom are in exile, who perhaps could take the lead in a restructured Salvadoran military and could therefore have a mandate to negotiate with the guerrillas. Such a negotiation, which would lead to military power sharing, might then lead to a form of government of transition and eventually elections. It's a risk, but the alternatives may be more severe. The alternatives may be a guerrilla victory in El Salvador or deeper American involvement of a military nature.
What can the United States do in order to turn the right-wing forces in El Salvador into negotiators with the left radical forces that have been fighting them?
Well, the United States provides a great deal of military aid to the Salvadoran army. It provides training. There can be leverage exerted. Moreover, there is another element which is extremely important, and it is, of course, the role of the regional powers. The Contadora group, made up of Panama, Venezuela, Mexico.
Let's see. It's Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, and Colombia.
And Colombia, right, which is also under a new democratically elected government. Now, in the case particularly of Venezuela and Mexico, who have taken the lead in the past, they feel very strongly that a negotiated solution is the only solution. These are the powers in the area whose security is most vital to the United States.
But are they really powers?
They are powers to the extent to which the United States can cooperate with them. Yes, they are. They provide to, for example, the Nicaraguan government, oil, sometimes at no cost or very low cost. They have great resources which they could make available to the area. But they could only work effectively if the United States backs what they are trying to do. In conversations with Venezuelan and Mexican leaders, it's clear that they share certain fundamental interests of the United States. They, too, wish to have the Cubans out of Central America. They, too, want these countries to settle their own destinies. They, too, are fearful of a spread of revolution. In short, their ends are not so different from the ends that we seek. It is the means that are different. They feel very strongly the United States must not use military aid and military intervention to accomplish these ends, that the only way to accomplish them is by forms of negotiation along the lines I have just sketched out. If these countries could take the lead, supported by the United States, I think there is a very good chance of some general stability in the area, even though you may not get perfect peace and harmony in any of these small countries.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chase. I'm Paul Kreisberg in New York for International Portfolio.
That ends side one of International Portfolio. Coming up on side two, an authority on communist regimes tells us what he